Conclusions, the fourth talk in a series entitled The False Gospel, was presented by Larry Barber and Jack Crabtree on June 15, 2008, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
And last week I looked at Galatians 2. The specific passage that I looked was at chapter 2, verse 11 through 21 in Galatians, and it's the account where Paul confronts Peter, a time where they were both in Antioch. There are really two conflicts there that come out in the passage. One is this overall conflict of there's a group of people who are would describe themselves as devout followers of Christ. They're advocating an interpretation of the gospel that's different, and that it's something that Paul is concerned about, and Paul calls it another gospel. And it's in this whole context of the letter of Galatians that Paul is actually confronting this perspective. And in Peter's, when Paul confronts Peter in his response to the party of the circumcision, we get an idea of exactly what this conflict is about. And then there's Peter's conflict. Peter makes a decision about how he is going to interact or to respond to this other gospel of the party of the circumcision. And it is out of that his response that Paul confronts him. Let me talk a little bit about the party of the circumcision. They are in the letter, Paul describes them as men from James. I'm not exactly sure why Paul describes or uses that description, but they would probably maybe use that term themselves, or certainly they're from the church in Jerusalem. It's unlikely that James would actually support these men, or certainly he would not support their attitude. They were a group of Jews who insisted that Gentile converts be circumcised and demanded that they keep the Mosaic law if they were to be regarded as true believers. They would kind of took it upon themselves. They made it their mission to follow after Paul. Like Paul would go into a district like the province of Galatia, and Paul would go in there and he would preach the gospel. Well, they would follow along after Paul and kind of counteract his evangelistic efforts by teaching their perspective. They wanted to make sure, from their perspective, that Gentile converts were correctly instructed in the matters of faith. What is likely is that this group felt pretty at home being in the community of Jerusalem. More importantly, the believing community in Galatia or in Jerusalem had not excluded them. And I think this is significant because externally, at least, they were a group who were Christian enough in their beliefs that they didn't really attract any negative attention. They had been exposed to apostolic teaching, and from all outward appearances, they were as Christian as you can get. I suggested last week that if you were to sit down and have a conversation with them, that they would tell you that they would believe that Jesus was the Messiah, that he was the Son of God. They would tell you that Jesus was crucified for their sins and raised up in order that they might be freed from condemnation. And I'm using that term, freed from condemnation, is in lieu of justification. Those who are followers of Jesus were free of condemnation on the basis of God's mercy. They would tell you that. They would suggest that a person who is a true believer will understand the need to be circumcised and keep the Mosaic covenant. This was because they believed that living righteously or following the law was a necessary condition for receiving eternal life. Paul would very much agree with the first of these three tenets, but he would disagree with the last tenet. And a traditional view of Galatians, or in the letter and the purpose of the letter, is that this is the issue, this disagreement between Paul on the one hand says that man is justified by faith and faith alone. On the other hand, the party of the circumcision would say, no, man is justified faith plus being circumcised and keeping the Mosaic law or works. And that's the perspective. And a lot of people see the book that way, and they see that that is the central issue of the book, this disagreement between Paul and the party of the circumcision in this sort of theological disagreement. I would like to suggest that that's not the problem here. The problem here is not a theological disagreement between Paul and the party of the circumcision. This disagreement is not the other gospel that Paul refers to. Jack, 2 weeks ago, taught that the same disagreement was in play in Romans 14, when he writes Romans 14, between the weaker brother on the one hand, who is the Jew, who believes that he must keep the law, or he must eat vegetables, he can't eat meat, he must keep the Sabbath. That's the weaker brother. It's the Jew, similar to the party of the circumcision. But as Jack noted, that the Paul's response to these Jews, to the situation in Rome, was he was merciful, he was understanding, he was accepting and tolerant. Here, in this letter, in contrast, Paul is harsh, he's confrontational, he's dramatic, and he calls their perspective a false gospel. So even though there is this disagreement between Paul and the party of the circumcision, that's not the problem here in Galatia. There's something else going on, because he responds very differently to the same issue in Rome and this issue here, okay? And I think if we look at specifically look at Peter's, this account of Peter's decision and his Paul's response, we get a feel for what this other gospel is. I noted that Paul observed some problems, made some observations in Peter's response to the party of the circumcision. He noted that, one, it was out of fear. Two, he described Peter's behavior as hypocritical. Peter was essentially afraid because he'd had experiences with this group of people before. He had had a revelation from God. He had met with Cornelius, if you remember, I think it's in Acts 10. He goes back to Jerusalem. He reports his revelation from God. He reports his interactions with Cornelius. And it's this group that harshly rebukes him. They were unmerciful. They were intimidating. And that's part of what Peter is responding to here. Paul also described Peter's behavior as hypocritical. In our culture, we think of hypocrisy as pretense, that the pretense of telling other people how they ought to live their lives while not consistently living those beliefs or so. But the first century understanding of hypocrisy is very different than our understanding. The term has its origin in the Greek theater, and it was used to describe an actor who portrayed a character in a play. So according to Paul, by withdrawing and separating himself from the Gentiles, Peter is acting out of script, and it is the fear of the party of the circumcision that is the motivation. It's underneath. That's what's motivating Peter's decision. The script that Peter is acting out is he is acting like he actually believes what the party of the circumcision believes. He is acting out this script that says you are an authentic disciple of Jesus only if you are in conformity to the requirements of the Mosaic law. Peter doesn't believe what the party of the circumcision believes, but he is acting like he does. His decision isn't to act and to withdraw and to separate himself from the Gentiles is not out of conviction. It is out of fear of experiencing the discomfort of their unmerciful judgment. Okay, let me just kind of summarize a little bit about how Paul responds to that. Basically, Paul says that, Peter, you and I have come to trust in Christ's death for God's mercy, not our own ability to achieve the moral goodness that the law demands. We have come to understand that we cannot achieve the moral goodness the law demands in order to be freed of condemnation. The crucifixion depicts the very condemnation that we deserve. So out of that understanding, Paul says to Peter that he no longer has the self-perception that he stood to attain eternal life on his ability to achieve moral goodness. And consequently, Paul says, he now lives his life based on his belief that Jesus' death was a manifestation of God's mercy on his behalf. That's essentially what Paul says to Peter. So how did Paul conclude that the members of the circumcision party had a false gospel, that it was beyond this theological disagreement? In spite of their outward appearances, the party of the circumcision exhibited an unmerciful, condemning attitude towards those who failed to conform to their way of thinking. We know that they had that condemning attitude is because that's what Peter was responding to. Peter was intimidated by them. He had had that experience before, and he didn't want to have it now, so he acted like he believed what they believed. He withdrew from the Gentiles like any good law-abiding Jew would. Therefore, anyone who adopts a condemning, unmerciful attitude towards others is likely to not be one who has understood their own need for mercy. At the heart of the false gospel that Paul is talking about here is not a wrong understanding of doctrine. Rather, at the core, the false gospel consists of not facing the truth of one's own moral unworthiness and need for God's mercy. What is the gospel then? The essential necessary content of saving faith in the gospel is one's personal, internal embrace of the truth of one's own moral unworthiness and consequently of the mercy of God as exhibited in Christ's death as the basis of hope for hope in eternal life. So that's pretty much what I wanted to say in terms of review. I want to say one more thing, though, in terms of just an overall my overall thought about this, looking at this passage, and what struck me about it is Paul is writing to taking on this conflict, but he's addressing this issue. The party of the circumcision they look like Christians. They think they're Christians. On the outward appearance, they look like Christians. They're doing things that Christians do. They talk like Christians. They believe the right things on the outside. But internally, what Paul sees here, inwardly, they've missed something that is a big problem, that's crucial. They really haven't seen their own need for mercy. Somehow, their view of the law actually kept them from seeing what was true internally, their own moral brokenness and their need for God. And that's why Paul calls it a false gospel, is because it looks like the real thing, but it's not. Externally, it looks like the same outwardly that anybody else might look like, but internally, it's wrong. It's anti-gospel, because it hasn't come to terms with our own need for mercy. And that's why Paul calls it another gospel, but not the gospel.
Okay, I don't really have anything to add to that. That was great. Let me just highlight one thing, and then what we want to do today is open it up for you to ask your questions and make your comments, and we'll just hash this out, because this is actually a very different paradigm for a lot of us, with some fairly unfamiliar concepts that we need to come to terms with. The thing that I find so compelling about this way of looking at Galatians is it finally makes sense out of who the circumcision party is. I mean, for years and years and years and years, the way the circumcision party always got presented to me and the my own hypotheses about who they are, proposes that they're basically Pharisaical Jews who are going to church in Jerusalem with James and hanging out with Christians. They deny that we're justified by faith. They think that we're justified by works instead of by faith, or at the very minimum, we're justified by works in addition to faith. Very implausible, historically implausible, that they could have any kind of solidarity with the believing, gospel-believing community in Jerusalem and not believe what Christians believe, not believe what the apostles believe. So the reason I looked at Romans 6, the first thing in this series, is in Romans 6, Paul makes it very clear that it's a part of his gospel that the only people, there is one huge condition on who it is that's going to receive mercy. It's the disciples of Jesus who are going to receive mercy. And then in Romans 6, he spells out what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. In the end of 6, he says, although you were servants of unrighteousness, you became obedient from the heart to that, whatever, however you translate it, that form of teaching that was delivered to you, and having become released from your servitude to unrighteousness, you became servants of righteousness. And what he's saying there is part and parcel to the decision to be a disciple of Jesus is the decision to purposely pursue righteousness in your life rather than purposely pursuing unrighteousness in your life. That's part of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. So from Paul's perspective, it's completely incompatible with the Christian faith to be tolerant of evil in your life. We will fail. We are depraved, morally degraded creatures, so we are going to fail in our efforts, but it won't be for lack of trying, because our purpose, our commitment, the commitment from deep within our being, is a commitment to strive to emulate the goodness of God in my very life. So given that that's the case, Paul is making it very clear, who is it that receives mercy? It's the people who've made a personal decision to be a servant of righteousness. Well, once you recognize that that's a key part of the apostolic teaching, would have been a key part of James' teaching in Jerusalem, you can see how a whole group of people within that context, enculturated as Jews, would simply go one step further and ask themselves the question, what does it mean to pursue righteousness? Well, duh, keep the law. And it becomes very, very plausible that you'd have a school of thought within Jerusalem that would just find that a no-brainer. Of course you have to keep the law. James doesn't even actually confront the issue because James has never confronted Gentiles. He lives in Jerusalem. He's surrounded by Jews. But Paul goes to Antioch, which is a very cosmopolitan city, where all of a sudden, there are these Gentiles who are responding positively to the gospel and becoming believers. And Paul has to think now, what is it that the life of Jesus, the death of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, and the teaching of Jesus, what does all that mean for these Gentiles who have never been a part of the Jewish nation to whom God delivered this or made this covenant and asked them to keep the law? And having thought through the implications of it, he realizes that with the coming of Jesus, things changed for everybody, Jew and Gentile alike. Not everything in the law was equally important. Not everything in the law was equally eternal. And there are some parts of the law that later in the New Testament he will call shadows of the substance which belongs to Christ. So he begins to make this distinction between the things of the law that are universally, transculturally, and eternally important, and those things that only had a temporary and provisional importance to the nation of Israel. And he decides the Gentiles don't have to bother with that. That's not for them. That's not a part of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. But that, like Larry points out, that and that alone is just simply an innocent doctrinal mistake for any Jew who doesn't see that. That's an innocent doctrinal mistake. What drives him crazy in Galatians is this underlying attitude of being censorious and judgmental and self-righteous and wagging the finger and heaping all kinds of shame and guilt on people because they're not living their lives as Christians the way I think you ought to live your life as Christians. And that Paul finds that attitude, that mindset from the inside, the core of who a person is what Paul finds fundamentally at odds with everything that the gospel proclaims, just like Larry was saying. So all that just makes a ton of sense to me, but we need to hash it out, so let's have at it.
So, okay, I don't want to hog this, but there's a lot to talk about here. So I want to start out by saying I really appreciate, I thought, Larry, last week and this week your presentation was really clear. I mean, you've put it there on the table for us to look at in a good way. And I know you guys have been looking at Galatians together here for quite a bit, and I admire what you've been doing. So the fact that I'm about to say I don't buy it, I don't want
the big bucks coming here. Yeah,
I don't want this to, I mean, you understand, I really respect your thinking and all of this stuff. I can't get there yet.
It's okay, Ron.
Okay,
we can dialogue.
So the part that I'm where I'm not with you, I think, seems to be the part that you're describing as your new way of thinking about this. I'm still thinking about it in the old way of thinking about it, and I I saw that finger wag. Okay, so it just doesn't seem to me. Okay, so here's my problem in describing it as it's not a theological disagreement; it's just their attitude.
That's not to say that there wasn't a disagreement.
No, I understand.
Right,
but that's the same thing in Romans 14. There was a theological disagreement there. Paul did not agree with the Jews who thought that they had to limit what it is they ate. But in that context, he didn't call that a false gospel.
Right.
What I'm saying is I'm still in the position that I would say that Paul would identify their false gospel as the theological disagreement. So I guess what I'm saying is I don't think it's quite fair to say it's the same disagreement. It's similar in that I agree that it has that element of what are we supposed to do with the law? I mean, we have the Mosaic Covenant back there with all of these things about eating and circumcision and all that kind of stuff. What are we to do with that? But one thing there are two things that you haven't addressed that I have always thought of in connection with the Galatians stuff. And so I guess I'll ask you how you're thinking about this, because these are part of the reason that I can't go where you're going. One of them is what it says in Acts about how there were certain men from Judea who came saying that you couldn't be saved unless you were circumcised. Okay, well, I don't think the people in Romans 14 were teaching you can't be saved unless you eat this way. So when Paul talks about a different gospel, the way I have always understood it, and it makes sense to me to take it this way, as the gospel, he's saying, in that context, he means the message of salvation. And so the Judaizers, their message of salvation was Christ is the way to salvation for everyone who obeys him by keeping the Mosaic law or something like that. So now I agree. What's at the heart of the problem there is the kind of attitude that you're talking about. I mean, I think it's self-righteousness that is at the... It's that I would buy a picture like that because I'm quite open to the idea that God gives me a list of things to do and I do it, and that would make me a good guy. And sure, I mean, Jesus kind of takes on the role like the sacrifices did in the Old Testament. I mean, you have to... You know, we're not perfect. He has to clean up a little bit. But fundamentally, it is because I have embraced and done these things. But that seems to me like a theological problem. And then The second thing is in Galatians, where Paul says to the Galatians, now they're the ones who have been listening to the Judaizers at this point. So his message is not to the Judaizers, you self-righteous, or rather you unmerciful, judgmental people. It's to the Galatians who have been listening to them. And this is where he comes and says, you know, you foolish Galatians, you know, having been begun by the Spirit, are you being perfected by the flesh? And in particular, that statement where he says, if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. Well, I mean, obviously, I don't think he means if you were to have the mistaken impression that part of what righteousness involves is keeping all the elements of the Mosaic covenant. So you say, well, I don't quite know why, but if I need to be circumcised, that's what I'll do. He's not saying God would never accept a person like that. It seems to me that he's saying you have embraced this gospel of the Judaizers. You have listened to them say it is only the person who keeps the law that would be saved. And you look at that and say, yeah, that makes sense to me. It's only the person who would keep the law that would be saved. So again, it's that action of getting circumcised is embracing a theology that is a different theology than the theology of the gospel. And the problem with embracing that theology is that it doesn't require me to come to terms with my unworthiness, because I can think, but I am worthy because I have done the things that I'm supposed to have done. So I don't mean to nitpick. I mean, I don't know. But this seems to be kind of at the heart of what you guys are saying, is that that's the place where the difference is. And the implications of that then become primarily what I'm interested in then is it's not theology that's the issue. It's whether a person is, you know, is unmerciful or something like that. And I think that's a complicated question. I think you can make a really big case that in a very significant way the Bible is teaching that theology very much is the issue. But it's theology as a reflection. What I believe ultimately is a question of that, of where I'm coming from, whether I'm willing to see myself for who I am. Okay, so, sorry, that's a lot of stuff.
How about if I take the first one, you take the second one? I think to get to your first question, I think that the information that Paul gives us here is that these men are actually, he describes them as from James, men from James, and so this is a group of people that are actually from the church at Jerusalem. So I think that's significant, because he's not saying they're outside the church, or they're a part of that community, and they're seen as part of that community. People don't think of them as having bad theology or that's not how they are thought of. But they look, from all outward appearances, they look very Christian, and but yet the way in which Peter responds to them, I think from Paul's perspective, is a clue to what's really true about them as people and as a group, and that is they have not come to terms with their own need for mercy, because they're not giving mercy to Peter, for example, who is going against what they believe to be true. But also, I think the reason that Paul comes so hard on down on this is because puts this section in the letter is because Paul sees the consequences of this. He sees immediately in this situation, he sees Barnabas, who's his buddy, and all the rest of the people following. And I think that's part of why he's taking this on and even writing the kind of things that he does in the letter, is because he is very concerned about the seductiveness of this and how contagious it can be, not just for that situation, but to the Galatians in general. And I think it's also it's hard to get at that attitude. And I think that's part of what Paul does here is, I mean, he uses theological language, but I think what's true, especially you see this in this context, which I think kind of helps me understand the rest of what's going on in Galatia. That's what's going on, is he's really taking on that attitude more than just the theology of it, if that makes sense.
And the way to make sense out of that in my mind is that you really have to make a distinction between one's explicit, overt theology and doctrine and one's working theology and doctrine. So both are theological, and that's why you can make a theological argument against it. But his concern is, you say you believe this, but you act like you believe this.
Right.
And what you act like you believe is what you really believe, and what you act like you believe is not the gospel. So that's why I think it's not a problem that he mounts a theological defense and is concerned about the theology of it, because he's concerned about the theology of their working understanding of how Christian discipleship is. And that's what's so interesting, is he makes arguments that he could have made against the Pharisaical Jews in Rome. I mean, it's the same argument in Galatians, parts of it. I mean, the parts of it are different, but parts of it you could lift out of Galatians and insert in the argument of Romans, and it would make perfectly good sense, because their working understanding is not the gospel. It's just Pharisaical Judaism all over again. And yet they have transcended that socially and culturally, have been hanging out with Christians who talk about mercy, the grace of God, Jesus dying for our sins, us being so incredibly unworthy that Jesus had to die for our sins. I think if you had explicitly asked the circumcision party, do you believe that stuff? They would have said, sure, yeah, we're Christians. But Paul says, then how comes you don't act like it? And that's what's so radical for me is... That is so important for us today to grasp, because we're so willing to give Christian culture a break. If you just say the right things, talk about the grace and mercy of God and how Jesus died for my sins, then you're my brother. But Paul is going to step further in saying, if I don't see the kind of tenderness and mercy and softness that the contrition that comes from someone who's seen the reality of their own sin and their need for Jesus dying on the cross for them, then I'll show you somebody who doesn't get it yet and is not one of us, is really not a believer along with us. And what happens then is, in Christian culture, all of us get so intimidated by the finger wagging of people around us that we all, like Peter, begin to act like we agree with them, even when we don't. But we act like we agree with them, and therefore the culture, that's the contagion that Larry was talking about, the culture that gets formed because of that is ultimately anti-gospel, anti-Christ, antithetical to faith and everything we stand for, even though many of us in that culture truly believe from the heart in the grace and mercy of God. So my answer is that I think that's why it's theological, is because it is theological, but it's not explicitly, overtly, and it's not a matter of the explicit creed that you proclaim. It's a matter of the beliefs that you actually live out in your attitude in life.
Okay. Well, I don't want to. I mean, you understand my problem. I agree with most everything that you guys have said. But I still don't understand. I mean, going back to the Acts thing, it seems to me like it was that they had a different creed.
Well, what I'm saying is that, see, Paul would say, unless you pursue righteousness, you cannot be saved. So the circumcision party says, yeah, that's right. Unless you keep the law of Moses, you can't be saved. So I think the doctrinal disagreement between Paul and the circumcision party is actually fairly subtle, that they have a different take on the law. I don't think Paul would, and I would argue that the weaker brother in Romans 14 would say that same thing. That's why they have the convictions that they do. That's why they keep the Sabbath and keep the dietary regulations. They believe they're under obligation to do that as disciples of Jesus. They think they would be being morally remiss to not do that.
Okay. Okay, well, that it's clear to me why we disagree then, because I was agreeing with most everything you guys said, but I don't think I agreed with anything that you just said there. So
okay.
That's where it is. Thank you.
If you accept the thesis that you just gave, how does one, as a Christian, articulate the correct position without being judgmental, divisive, and
I missed what you heard.
How do you articulate what you're describing Paul was articulating without being schismatic and divisive and judgmental to the greater evangelical subculture?
Well, you probably don't. But notice how schismatic Paul is being.
Yeah.
And Paul doesn't think all schism is bad, as he says in 1 Corinthians. And it in part, he says, how's he put it? Heresy must exist in order that those who are approved might become evident. That is, that there are some schisms that are really about the gospel itself, mm-hmm. that really clarifies what is it that we believe as Christians? Do we or do we not believe this thing?
Figuring. So do you think this is a fight worth having then? Or
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah.
Do you have any idea how to start that?
I have lots of ideas.
Dave. Oh, okay. That's okay.
Well, I kind of want to follow up on that because I think that's a really big question. How do we do that? And I was thinking as you guys were talking about how a lot of times I'll come back to where I'm going, I think, but we often teach at the study center a class on sexuality and relationships, and in the course of doing that, I often talk with young people who are saying, how do I know the person I'm about to marry is a believer? Okay? And so the question comes up of if they say all the right things, what if they're, you know, how do I know for sure? And one of the things I often say to them is, well, obviously we can't really know because we can't peer into somebody else's heart. But for me, one of the things that I would look for is a person who is willing to look at their own failure. And so seeing a softness inside another person for evaluating their failure, for working with that personal conflict inside your relationship, if there's a sense that this person is unwilling to be wrong, that's a bad sign. And it's a bad sign for marriage. It's a bad sign about their heart of faith as well. So maybe you see where I'm going with this. It's kind of like you're saying with the larger Christian culture, the issue is not that they don't say all the right stuff. The issue is they don't believe it if they're not willing to be humble and broken together in communities. I mean, is that a good way to say it? It's like in our community then, you're kind of bringing this to the community level of how do you evaluate a particular community of believers? Now, every person in that community is not going to be somebody who is willing to do that. But maybe there's a spirit of the community that embraces this gospel that says we are really vulnerable to self-righteousness. We are really vulnerable. One of the things that's hitting me as you're talking is what's contagious about it and what's really seductive about it is that we don't like to see ourselves as failing. We don't like to see ourselves as not worthy in our daily lives, in our daily... I mean, I find myself... I mean, it's kind of a routine event in my world to kind of go, oh, yeah. You know? I mean, and by the grace of God, God keeps, like, you know, pounding my face into that. But I think that's really significant because we can really live our lives in such a way, even those of us who, I think, embrace this view of the gospel... We can get far away from that. It's easy to get far away from that. And so yeah. I appreciate that you're saying it's easy in communities to get away from that. And so anyway, so my question is similar to this man's, that how do we respond to the larger Christian community when inside any community there are people who really do embrace the true gospel, and perhaps they're being led down a road to not to be able to be blind to that somehow by their church leaders, by cultural stuff, I don't know. But I think it's a really legitimate and profoundly important question, how we interact with that.
It makes sense, because that's exactly part of why Paul is writing the letter, because he sees the contagiousness of it, the seductiveness of it, and how easily it spread right there. Mm-hmm. So and we know the difficulty that we all have in looking at our own brokenness. And certainly, why wouldn't it be true in a community? So let me say one more thing, and then Jack can... What struck me about this, I mean, just my own process of God working in my life and showing me what's true about myself and what's true about the gospel, is what's been more clear for me has been we're in a community where there's this idea that we value righteousness and we pursue righteousness. And I think that was true for the party of the circumcision too. I mean, they would say those words. Maybe they'd say them a little bit differently, articulate them a little bit differently, but the notion would be there. But I think what's true, what I've seen is true here, is that the way to think about the value of righteousness begins with really seeing my brokenness, that they're inseparable. And that I think that's something that's difficult to think about in that way. And I don't think as a culture that we think about pursuing righteousness as figuring out what the right thing to do is and trying to do it, which isn't bad, but we leave out this other big piece, which I think is the bigger problem. Does that make sense? Do you want to?
The light went on for me when Larry and I were talking at one point, and Larry used the phrase, they think they can transcend their sinfulness. Yeah. And that's when the light went on for me, is that's the problem. That's where we don't get the gospel, is when we can simply say, boy, I used to be a lousy sinner, and then I came to Jesus, and now look at me. We don't get it. You know, we don't understand how deep, how intractable, how entrenched my own moral depravity is. As I was saying a few weeks ago, I mean, I think the biblical perspective is sin has insinuated itself into the very fabric of our personalities. And so just being who I am is already making me unworthy. Just being who I am is already harmful to people, toxic to people at times, because I'm just... infected with sinfulness. Well, that's the perspective into which the gospel came, not the perspective that, you made a couple of mistakes. Let Jesus take care of those couple of mistakes you made, and now you'll be fine. But you, your very being is a problem, and Jesus has died on the cross so that God won't hold your being against you. Well, that's a radically different perspective, and I think that's what the circumcision party, for all of their doctrine, for all of their saying the right things about Jesus, don't really get what Larry just described. That's what they don't understand about themselves. Now to your question. I may be wrong about this, but I'm really inclined to think it's not the preachers and the teachers in the church that drive the churches. Right. It's what we say to each other in the parking lot in the foyer on the way out. It's all those offhanded little comments that actually shape our perspectives and our worldview. And forge them. And that ends up ultimately coming back and determining what the preacher preaches. So what can we do? We can have the courage to be those messy failures who are totally acknowledging our depravity among each other and with each other, and not be afraid of putting forth that that face, if you will, I mean, which is our, the truth about us, to be naked before each other spiritually and morally.
Not be afraid of what Peter was afraid of.
Exactly. And the more of us that do that, that's what undermines the power of hypocrisy and the power of this mindset, is when enough of us are going to say, I'm not going to be afraid to just admit that I'm a failure.
Kay and I missed last week, so perhaps this was addressed last week, and I'm sorry. And maybe everybody else in the room here gets it, and I don't, but I just have a question. How, let's see, is the difference between the readers in Romans 14 and the circumstances in Galatia, is the difference that in Romans 14 your view is that they are not trying to transcend their own sinfulness?
Yes, and add to that, in Romans 14, he's not actually addressing a situation that has happened. He's anticipating a possible situation that he wants to warn them against. When I taught that, I'm proposing that these are a whole boatload of Jews are returning to Rome with the letter in hand, and they have not lived in community together for 7 years. So they're going to be reintroduced back into the Roman church, Jews now coexisting in community with Gentiles for the first time in 7 years because of the edict of Claudius had kicked them out. And he's just warning them. Basically what he's warning them when he says, don't condemn the brother who eats, he's saying, don't join the circumcision party. You're going to be tempted to be one of those people, one of those believers who can't get past the fact that Gentiles aren't Jews and can't get past the fact that God has a different story to tell in the Gentiles than the Jews, and you're going to narrow-mindedly and dogmatically condemn them even though you can see the reality of the faith in their life. Well, don't go there, he's saying. Don't be those kinds of people. So it's a warning. It's not addressing a situation that's an actual real-life situation that's going on, whereas Galatians is. They've already succumbed to the seduction of the circumcision party.
Thanks.
But what I am saying is, it is possible to live in community with each other having deep commitments that disagree with one another about what it looks like to live a Christian life, and yet still acknowledge, accept, and respect the faith of one another,
yeah,
realize the genuineness of the faith.
But in Galatians, it sounds like he's not respecting the faith. I mean, it sounds like you're saying he's not respecting the faith because he doesn't think it's genuine.
Right. That's
and
right.
I guess that's the nub, the heart of my issue, is how does he know that there? And in Romans 14, it's the very opposite. It's 180-degree tact. I don't think I have enough confidence to be able to read other people's real heart and intentions and motives. I can't read my own.
Well, you need to get better.
Are we having meat at the reception today? I don't want just vegetables. I want meat.
I think the part that's tricky about Christian culture is that I meet people that it's not an issue of they don't know their brokenness, they don't know the degree of their brokenness. So can you address that?
I think that's true. I mean, there's sort of, I mean, it's hard to read the Bible without having some sort of intellectual assent to Jesus died for our sins. I mean, but to see, it's like what Jack was talking about a minute ago, about how toxic we are and how hurtful we are and how destructive we are, at the level to which we are is another issue altogether. And that's what I think Paul is talking about in terms of this inward realization of our brokenness and our need for mercy, it's on that level, rather than just saying, oh yeah, Jesus died for our sins and that's part of what we believe, that's what Christians believe. So there is a huge difference, distinction. Ted?
I've always known that I've done wrong, but it wasn't until much later in life that I realized I couldn't do right.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's where there's that process. You know, I'm always, kind of like what Dave's saying, away, I'm hesitant how much to speak up in certain circles because I look at it and I go, okay, this young family's in process. You know, give them a couple more years, they're going to see the degree of their brokenness in a different way and how they're interacting with their children or whatever. That surely happened in my own life. So they may have, because of the degree of brokenness, seems to be related to how much they think they can transcend their sinfulness. Those are intricately related, and thus, that's where sometimes I think I find it hard to speak up, because I know it's been such a process for me too, even though from the get-go I understood my sinfulness. It's like there's two different things out there. There's the people in process in the Christian culture who get it very, very slowly but surely, and then there's people who are just die-hard, arrogant, but speak all the language.
So that's what Dave needs to learn to discern. I think that's a good answer.
Yes.
To your question, Dave, is that, I mean, we can't read ultimately the condition of people, but there's this stark contrast that I know that you recognize and have experienced.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I know it's there. I guess I don't have the confidence to know who is who.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if it's possible. Well,
but that doesn't matter. See, that doesn't matter. It's not about what I'm going to say to you. It's about what I'm going to say about myself, I think.
Right.
I mean, isn't that where it starts? Is if I am honest about myself, I'm and not intimidated into playing the game that I have now, yes, let me join you in transcending my sinfulness along with you. That's what's deadly, is when I get intimidated into the same play acting where I'm going to pretend like I'm just as good as you are now at being a disciple of Jesus in the way that we all know that we have to do. And that doesn't require that I make an assessment of other people. It only requires that I have the courage and honesty to speak the truth about myself.
It requires to not make that judgment.
Yeah, really, in the end, that's what the gospel implies.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Starting with me is, do I find myself being merciful to people and not judgmental? And then what do I do with when I find myself doing that? Do I, oops, there it is, and then how do I respond to that? That's where I think it really begins.
Right next door here. I was just going to add one more thing, that in this passage, it appears to me like Paul is not confronting any individual. He's not looking around and saying, you're a miserable person because you have this bad theology. He's actually confronting Peter. He's confronting people who are responding to a spirit that is causing them to be something that they're not. So he's not going around trying to decide to make a division between individuals that you're in, you're out. He's right. Talking about the impact that this whole pervasive theology and perspective is having on everybody and getting them to think about themselves. So.
Galatians can be truly confusing.
What'd you say?
Galatians can be truly confusing.
It's a very difficult book.
He says, well, the law is not by faith because you have to do it. And then he says, but if you just do the law, you're not of faith. And he says to support Ron's contests there. He says that if you receive circumcision, then you're under obligation to keep the whole law. You've been severed from Christ. If you're seeking to be justified by law, you have fallen from grace. And it seems like that seems to be the theological issue there, is that the investment in effort and accomplishment rather than the helplessness of mercy is seems to be, I think, the theological divide. But if you go over into 5:18, 19, where he says, the deeds of the flesh, you're not of the Spirit, you're under the law. You're not under the law, you're of the Spirit. The deeds of the flesh are evident, and these are immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, on and on and on. Do you think that the circumcision party would have said, the deeds of the flesh are evident? Eating pork, not wearing your prayer shawl, breaking the Sabbath, etc., etc., etc.
I mean, probably not, because I don't think they have thought that deeply about it. I mean, to be consistent, that's what they'd have to say, but I don't think they would be that consistent.
So when they're sitting at the table, and they ask the guy next to him, "Are you circumcised?" and he says, "No," so they move down a chair, and then they say, "Is that pork in that salad?" "I think so." They go to another table, and then they get to that table, and they say, "So we're all wearing our prayer shawls, right?" "Well, I'm not." So then they go to another table. Are they saying then that, "Well, I know you're not really a believer, and I don't want to be contaminated by you because you're eating pork, not circumcised, and not wearing your prayer shawl"? Or do they sit at the table and say, "Okay, which one of you guys is sleeping with your girlfriend and stealing money from your employer?" And okay, and then moves down a seat, and then says, "Oh, which one of you is anger? Has outbursts of anger and is filled with jealousy?" And move over to another table. I mean, it seems to me that the theological question is the root, because it is the great divide. And yet, I can't understand, again, that emphasis on, well, it's the personal interactions that identify you as not being a believer being the concern that Paul has. I'm not really wording this well, but I'm really hearing what Ron is saying, and that really hits me. So what I have to know then is, if Paul's going to sit down with these two people sitting at these two tables and say, "Okay, why won't you sit with this guy, and why won't you sit with this guy?" Is he going to say, "I know he's not really a believer," or he's going to contaminate me because, is he going to say it's because he eats pork and he doesn't wear his prayer shawl and he's breaking the Sabbath? I mean, it's okay, we need to re-educate here. This is not the gospel I gave you.
Okay, that's exactly the problem in Galatians.
Right.
Okay. Because what he's going to answer is, this guy's not really a believer because he's not eating kosher. That's what he's going to answer. So why then does right out of the chute, the issue that Paul addresses is not the nature of the law? Why is it that right out of the chute he addresses a different theological issue? Is it by grace and mercy that we stand before God, or is it by our keeping the law? It's that issue that he addresses, when their answer would not have been, "You know what? I think people are justified by works and not by faith, and this guy is not doing the work, so he's not a believer." That's not what they would say. So why does he address a theology that they would never espouse? I think it's because you have to make a distinction between the explicit disagreement that they all self-consciously acknowledge and the implicit tacit disagreement that is operating at the level of their mentality and their mindset. And that's the one that's important to Paul, is that one.
I think you've raised a really important question, Logan, and that is that those were the that was the conflict back then in that culture. What's the conflict now? How does that play itself out in our lives today, in our culture, in our attitudes towards other people? What kind of things do we, what kind of beliefs do we have, do we hold on to that we're unmerciful or judgmental about towards other people, where we don't give people mercy?
Because no right-thinking disciple of Jesus could think like that or value what they value or do what they do or practice what they practice. Take politics, for example.
I mean, politics, divorce, homosexuality, alcohol. I mean, the list goes on. Whether you agree theologically or doctrinally with somebody, with a culture.
But just so we're clear, it's not that there is no definitive right and wrong.
Correct.
There is, absolutely. It's not about relativism. It's not about fuzzing up the moral pictures so that we accept everyone and everything because everything is equally valid. Far from that. It's about mercy and grace. You understand mercy and grace, the more clearly you understand the difference between right and wrong, the more clearly you're going to understand the need for mercy and grace.
Correct.
Because the more clearly you will come to realize how depraved you are and how bent you are and how broken you are.
Right.
So nothing in anything that we're saying is to suggest that we fuzz the lines between goodness and evil at all. We should keep them as sharp as we can. But in all of our seeking to keep those sharp, not everybody's going to be exactly on the same page at this point in time. So the question becomes, but do they believe in the grace and mercy of God as the basis of their salvation in the face of their moral depravity that they acknowledge?
Or do I even have mercy towards them even if they are not a believer or
right.
wherever they are in the process of their belief?
Right.
Thank you. A couple of observations, and then you can tell me how backwards I am. It seems like the straw that's breaking the camel's back for Paul is the difference between sinfulness and evil. And let me kind of, I mean, sinfulness can be evil, and sinfulness is evil, but there is a line from which someone is deliberately blind and someone who is accidentally blind. So, for example, I'm a businessman. I've been in the construction trades for 30 years, so I know a lot about construction. I have access to a lot of resources that inform me about the construction trade. There are other people that also are in construction business, and they have been in business for 30 years as well. And I have no disagreement with them when they say, I like to install my crown molding in this way, because the finished product is the same. And whether they're slower or faster than me doesn't offend me, because it's not, you know, it's neither here nor there. However, when Widow Jones calls me and says, I've got this construction company that has also been in business for 30 years, I'm now in the sixth year of my bathroom remodel, and I'm $20,000 over budget, and he wants another $50,000 from me, I can say, based on my knowledge and experience, this guy is defrauding you. And my disposition towards him is going to be different. She will retain me and has, as a matter of fact, to fight against the evil of this man who has the same resources as I have. But his disposition towards the resources are completely different than my disposition. I don't run my business perfectly, but I want to run my business perfectly. I have resources to do so. This other person has no desire to do that. And I guess my question is, don't we as believers have an obligation to fight evil from the standpoint, not because I can judge your heart, But I can say, wow, your actions are being hurtful to people who are helpless. And that happens to involve me somehow. I mean, it's my child, or it's my grandmother, or it's someone who's helpless. Isn't it then my job to say, you know, you call yourself a Christian, but this is wrong. And my goal is not to punish, but to redeem, help that person kind of look at themselves and say, wow, I'm really hurting people. But if they don't want to look at themselves, then isn't my disposition within the scope of legality and my power to then fight against, confront that evil? Am I making any sense at all?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how to answer your question, but you've illustrated very well the distinction I was trying to make about being a servant of righteousness and yet not perfect. I mean, what you describe yourself as wanting to run your business with integrity and honesty and forthrightly, that's what it means to be a servant of righteousness. And the fact that you describe yourself as failing, that's what it means to be a sinner. That we get caught off guard, we get selfish when we don't want to be selfish. It just comes so naturally to us that we do things that are wrong, do things that are wicked, do things that are sinful. But the disposition of your own heart and the commitment of your own being is to have everything that you do reflect the glory of God, to be righteous, to be good, to be honest, to have integrity. So that's what Paul is getting at as a servant of righteousness. But I'm not sure how to answer your question. Yes, I think we have an obligation to confront evil. How, in what way, in what context, that gets very complicated and very complex. But my simple answer is, yeah, I think we do.
I think we need to be very careful, though, because it's easy to cross the line into being judgmental. We need to do it with humility. I mean, we need to be, it's like Jack was talking about, we need to be clear about what's right and wrong. We're not suggesting we be fuzzy about that, but we need to know that we are toxic, we are broken ourselves, and so it behooves us to approach that, however we go doing that, with humility.
Well, and it seems like Paul's disposition towards, you know, the weaker brother, I mean, it's like, I've got people in my life and they go, gee, you know, I'm having a really bad day. I guess I just didn't have my quiet time this morning, you know. Well, they really mean it. I mean, they really, the quiet time for them is really a meaningful spiritual thing, interaction that they have with God, and they really mean it. They're sincere about that. I think it's nuts. Does that mean I disown them? Does that mean I say, well, brother, you know? I mean, do I correct them? Well, no. Because it's not about evil. It's about, you know, they're in a different place than I'm at. But if their disposition is, and you're such an asshole because you didn't have a quiet time, well, then it's different. Because then it crosses over into self-righteousness. And then I can fight against evil by saying, I beg your pardon. Is that...
Yeah. I think depending upon the context,
the relationship.
And the relationship that you have with them. I mean, do you have any latitude to speak there in that relationship in such a way? Is there any real opportunity that they might hear you? Otherwise, you're just talking to yourself. And
yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not advocating vigilanteism, but I'm, you know, I'm. I guess I've experienced that there's a larger emphasis on unity, even at the expense of truth. It's like, well, we all just need to get along. You know, well, yeah, but that's freaking evil. I mean, what he did right there, that's evil, and we need to talk to him about that, or her, or it.
Yeah. You probably need to let the children.
Okay. One more question.
Okay. This is something that comes to mind there, a little saying there. This is when it comes to this about confronting people, you should, the same one is something like, you take care of yourself, let God take care of the world. Okay, I think that's a good thing to do. Also, when it comes to the Good Samaritan, if you come up on somebody and they're hurt, and there's three people there, and you happen to be the one that starts saying, well, I'm going to take care of this person, then you confront it. It's kind of the same way when you see evil. You don't go, I used to try to go out and seek it. I don't like this, and I'm going to go out and attack it. That's not my job to go out and attack it. But if I come in, but if it's right in front of me, I shouldn't sidestep it. I should say, no, you're wrong. This is not right. This is the way you think. And then let them decide or to deal with what, if you've made your point that this is the way I think it should be, and not back away from it.
That's good.
Thank you all for your great questions and the dialogue. Thank you.